15 verses, chapter 20. We're looking at the millennium, and this is in chapter 20, verses 1 through 15. In the first three verses, we look at the binding of Satan. This is verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. So here you have an angel that is coming down, and he has the key, and the purpose of this is going to be to restrain Satan for a period of time. In verse 2, and he sees the dragon, and here Satan is seen as the dragon, that ancient serpent, that's the one from Genesis, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So, we see that the purpose of this angel was coming down with the key in his hand to the bottomless pit. He now seizes Satan, and he basically binds him for 1,000 years. And then in verse 3, and he threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. So here, Satan is thrown into the abyss for 1,000 years. And I made some notes here from thoughts from what other scholars had said. The thoughts about binding Satan, it could have been that all of his earthly activities will cease. The 1,000 years can be taken literally or figuratively, however your interpretation goes. The binding of Satan for 1,000 years and the 1,000-year reign of Christ are probably inseparable, since it picks up immediately after this. So those are three thoughts. Now in verses 4 through 6, we find the millennium itself. And of course, Satan will be released after this for a little while in the latter part of verse 3. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those who had authority to judge. To judge was committed. I also saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. There's four ways to interpret the judges sitting on the throne. The first way is that the judges are an angelic court. A second way, and it's noted in this text, is they were resurrected martyrs who exercised judgment and ruling during the millennial reign. That's the second way. So you have, it's an angelic court, it's martyrs who were resurrected, and they become part of the millennial reign with Christ. It could refer to those who did not die during the tribulation period. However, the issue there is, obviously, that these people, they came to life. So I would say that interpretation is probably not correct. Some scholars, a few of them, believe that this is believers in general that had either something to do with the tribulation period, those that were killed, those that were martyred, or it could be they believe believers in general overall. Several things about these martyrs. First of all, they were killed for the testimony of Christ. Given the fact that we've just gone through this horrific period basically starting from chapter 16 till now, knowing that there would be martyrs killed, I would probably be more likely to identify those with those that were killed during that period. That'd be my understanding. It could be those that lost their physical bodies but are very much alive. In other words, their souls did not die, but their bodies did. Or they could have been those that refused to bow down and worship the beast during the tribulation. So those are possible thoughts as far as who these martyrs are. The main thing to remember, though, regardless of your interpretation, is that these martyrs were killed because of their testimony for Christ. Would that include the martyrs that are dying today? I don't know. That's a good... If we limit the Acts just to here, then it would probably be those that died during that period. But that's a real good question. In verse 5 now, the rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. So the big question is, what is the first resurrection? It could refer to those resurrection of all Christians. It could be that second death has no power over them. Or that there will be joy in being in that first resurrection. That's a very difficult translation. So I'm going to leave that open for you guys to discuss as we go through this. Verse 6 now, we do know that there will be joy in being in the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and Christ, and of Christ. They will reign with him for 1,000 years. So whatever these, I'm assuming the first resurrection, in my own understanding, applies to these people that are raised during this millennial period. I think that's pretty good interpretation. But the question is, what is the purpose of this millennium? Why didn't God just kind of end it? I mean, he could have. Why didn't he do that? I think that's a good question. I wrote three things down here. First of all, to demonstrate within history the victory of righteousness over evil. Secondly, this way of purpose for the millennium is to reveal that humanity's rebellion against God lies deep in the heart of man. And third, the release of Satan after the millennium reveals the invincibility of God's kingdom. So here you have this period where Satan is going to be bound. There's going to be this judgment that takes place, and it's obviously the martyrs are somehow involved with this judgment, that they are going to reign with Christ those 1,000 years. And then Satan is going to be released again. And so what we're trying to figure out is, what is the purpose for that millennium? And I think all three of those do a good job at identifying what the possibilities are. But there's no doubt that third one that I said, the invincibility of God's kingdom, is number one. Because his kingdom will not be beat. Now we go to the last insurrection and destruction of Satan. And this goes from verse 7 through verse 10. Now we go there, and when the 1,000 year ended. And again, I'm taking that 1,000 years to be literal. Though some see this as metaphorically because of, you know, one day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is one day. You could turn it that way. When those days are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations, this is verse 8, that are the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather for battle. David, there's your final battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over a broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of saints, the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil, this is verse 10, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire, sulfur where the beast and the false prophets were, and they were tormented day and night forever and ever. So here you have a situation where Satan is released. He's able to, after this 1,000-year millennial reign, after this 1,000-year period, if you don't like millennial reign, we just say 1,000 years, he is released, and he will lead this, he'll take that time after he is released, he will go to the four corners of the earth, he will get an army that will finally assault, or lead an assault on God. And this reference to Gog and Magog, it could be pagans. If you go back maybe sometime down the road, Maybe this week you can look up Ezekiel 38 and 39. Some see this, that they are not literal but symbolic names for the enemies of God. But in any event, when Satan is released, there's no way around it. They are gathering them for battle. So there's going to be a showdown with the God's people. And it doesn't end well. Who are the rebels? And I made another note here. Who are the rebels that will fight against God's people? It could be, and one scholar said it could be some that defected during the millennium that will actually join this group. Depending on if you believe Christians can apostate, that's an interesting scenario. I think it's those that, particularly those that were alive after this 1,000-year period, probably those, and Satan's going to have this army that's going to come against God. That army has to come from somewhere. He wasn't able to deceive them during that 1,000-year because he was locked up. Is this another group that's going to come in and fight? Is it those that were dead that are going to be brought back? That's a good question. Okay, but notice in verse 9, very clearly, I think this is a reference to Jerusalem, and they marched up and over a broad plain of the earth, surrounded the camp of saints and the beloved city, and I think that's probably Jerusalem. But fire came from heaven and consumed them. So they are destroyed. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire along with the beast and the prophets, and they were tormented forever and ever. Some, and I want to make sure I clarify this. Some scholars, most of them agree with me on this, that it's probably Jerusalem, but some say it could be a metaphor for God's people. That is, you are the temple of God, and they surround him. I'm not sure how that fits, but that's their thoughts on it. Anyway, Satan is cast into the fire. It's been long awaited. The lake of fire, Jesus talked about it in Matthew 5:22, Matthew 7:19, and Matthew 10:28. So this is the conclusion now. Well, now we have the final judgment in verses 11 through 15. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. This should really make us understand something, that there is a day of judgment coming. Regardless to how you think this whole thing shakes out, there's a very real judgment coming. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. Listen to this. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the book according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And this is the second death that doesn't touch the believers. That's clear. We don't go through this. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So here you have this great judge, the final judgment of mankind. Heaven and earth flee from his presence. This great white throne probably indicates holiness and righteousness of God, and why these even earth and heaven could not stand before him. These books were opened. There's a moment of tension that pervades this text. The books are open. One gets the sense of, am I in the book of life? And I know I said this morning that hell's very real. And I believe with all of my heart that what John is writing here is very real. No one will be exempt from his judgment. Notice verse 12, he says, great and small are going to stand before him. This judgment is unavoidable. This judgment is going to take place whether you believe it is real or not. It's going to happen. Death and Hades certainly are going to be thrown into the lake of fire. Unredeemed man is condemned, particularly in verse 15. And if anyone's name was not found written in the Lamb's book of life, or the book of life, excuse me, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So here you have this culmination, if you will, of all the events that have taken place. You have this final battle in which Satan doesn't appear to be much of a battle. It seems like they're all gathering around either God's temple or God's people. Seems like they're surrounded, but they are completely destroyed. And that unequivocally, everyone will stand before those that are particularly lost, that are not in the Lamb's Book of Life. They will stand before God. And I've thought about this, and I've read different scholars, and we have no idea what is written in those books as far as what everybody's done. But this is the truth. Everything that was written in that book, everything that they've done in there, says according to what they have done, God is keeping a record. And how long that's going to take, I have no idea. But I do know that somehow, I don't want this to sound bad when I say this, but it will be some way of vindication. For all the things that have happened to us as believers, there will be a note of vindication for us. All the things that people have done that they think they're getting away with, that's going to be revealed. The final outcome is very sad because there's no escape. And if you're an atheist, the atheist says there is no God, okay. You go with that, and on the day of judgment, when the book is opened, and your name is there, and your name is, all the stuff that you've done is read, all the secret things, it's going to be too late. Because God's going to judge them. So in some sense, there's vindication. In other sense, there's great sadness, because I know Bill has said this many times, and others have said this, that, you know, this is real. This is real, and this is going to take place. And chapter 20, probably more than any chapter, at least these five verses, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, these verses should motivate us as believers in Christ to go out and share the gospel, because our names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. We don't undergo this. And like I said this morning in the sermon, we're not destined for wrath, we're destined for heaven. I get burdened in my heart about my father and others in my family, and I don't care how much my dad thinks this is a big joke and a game. I've read that verse to him. He said, that's just fantasy. And I said, okay, Dad, you can call it whatever you want. But when you stand before God, you can't say to him, your son, Michael, never told you. It should really motivate us.